The final episode of the popular sitcom Seinfeld 25 years ago in 1998. It received a lot of criticism for, as it was termed, moralizing. What happened is this. Jerry Seinfeld received a contract from NBC to do a sitcom for the network, and the network was going to fly Jerry as well as his three friends, Elaine, George, Kramer, to Paris as a gift. The plane had problems as they were trying to take off, and they ended up getting stuck in Lakeland, Massachusetts. Killing the time, they were started wandering on the street sidewalks of this quaint little village, Massachusetts, of Lakeland, and suddenly, before their eyes, there was a carjacking that occurred. Being New Yorkers and the kind of people they were, they started making fun of the guy who was being robbed. Kramer, who had a camcorder in his hands, started filming the incident out of curiosity. They never shouted out. They never lifted that hand to help, even though they were only 10 yards away from the individual who was being robbed. They just stood there, casually watched. The robbers then sped away in the car. Police arrived on the scene. And with the excitement, Jerry suggested they go and get something to eat. They turned to walk away, and the officer stopped them. The officer said, "All right, hold it right there." Jerry said, "Why?" The officer said, "You're under arrest." Jerry said, "Under arrest? What for?" The officer said, "Article 223-7 of the Lakeland County Penal Code." Elaine said, "What? What did we do? We didn't do anything." The officer said, "That's exactly right. The law requires that you help or assist anyone in danger as long as it is reasonable to do so." George says, "I never heard of that." The officer said, "It's new. It's called the Good Samaritan Law. Let's go." And so they're hauled off to jail, and then they start going back in history of the program of Seinfeld, showing the people that they have offended, the people that they failed to help throughout the whole tenure of the Seinfeld episodes. We use the expression Good Samaritan on people. Firefighters, rescue workers, that anonymous person who stopped and helped a little old lady change a flat tire. We use it on hospitals. Even there are laws, because the moral and humane thing to do is to help a neighbor in need. The expression is taken from Luke chapter 10, 25 to 37. Let's go there. Luke 10, verse 25 to 37. Last time we dealt with the first part of this in verses 25 to 29. The lawyer comes to Jesus Christ and asks him a question. What could he do to inherit eternal life? Jesus Christ then turns the questioning back on the lawyer, asking him, "Well, you are a lawyer. What does the law say?" And the lawyer answered, "You shall love the Lord your God with all your heart, with all your soul, and your neighbor as yourself." Christ says, "That is good. Great answer. That is the answer. Do that and live." But the lawyer, wanting to justify himself, asked the second question, which he shouldn't have, but he did it. And it is that second question from which we get the story of the Good Samaritan. We addressed the second question in form last time, but now we're going to go a little bit further. Luke chapter 10, beginning with verse 29. But he, the lawyer, wanting to justify himself, said to Jesus, "And who is my neighbor?" Jesus answered and said, "A certain man went down from Jerusalem to Jericho and fell among thieves, who stripped him of his clothing, wounded him, and departed, leaving him half dead. Now by chance a certain priest came down that road, and when he saw him, he passed by on the other side." Verse 32, "Likewise the Levite, when he arrived at the place, came and looked and passed by on the other side. But a certain Samaritan, as he journeyed, came where he was, and when he saw him, he had compassion. So he went to him, bandaged his wounds, pouring on oil and wine, and he set him on his own animal, brought him to an inn, and took care of him. On the next day, when he departed, he took out 2 denarii, gave them to the innkeeper, and said to him, take care of him, and whatever more you spend, when I come again, I will repay you. So he asked then the question to the lawyer, verse 36, which of these 3 do you think was neighbor to him who fell among the thieves? And the lawyer's response, verse 37, he who showed mercy on him. Then Jesus said to him, go and do likewise. First of all, Christ did not say that this was a parable. It could have been a parable, or it could have been something that actually happened in a real life time. For Christ to tell a story or even a parable to the Jews, especially with priests and Levites in it, and they are looking bad, and the most dreaded people for the Jews at that time, the Samaritan, to look good, could very well be dangerous, could be self-defeating. They could have said, hey, you just made that up. That would never have happened. Nothing like that is going to happen in our day and age. So it is possible some of his listeners, including the lawyer, knew that maybe such a thing actually happened. Such a thing actually occurred. Also, nowhere in the story does the word good occur. It is not used. I don't know if you've ever noticed that. Through the years, however, the word good has become synonymous with this man who dared to be a neighbor to a stranger who happened to be an enemy of the Jews, because the stranger had a need. So again, as we pick this up, verse 30. Jesus answered and said, certain man went down from Jerusalem to Jericho, fell on thieves who stripped him of his clothing, wounded him, and departed, leaving him half dead. The man is not identified, but is most likely a Jew coming from Jerusalem as he is headed to Jericho. Jericho is about 20 miles away from Jerusalem, going down a decline of about 3,600 feet. The road was narrow, winding, where criminals could hide and ambush victims. I think about certain places in major cities that are notorious for crime. When we first moved to Chicago, I was told where I should not go. I was given a map, and on that map, there were different ethnic groups living in their restricted areas, so to speak. And these are places I was told to avoid as much as possible. But coming to those areas, I couldn't avoid because they were in the South Side area. One on the west side of the highway that divided the city, the Dan Ryan. One on the east side of the Dan Ryan as well. Now, on the west side, we had the ballpark, Comiskey Park, for the Chicago White Sox. It's quite amazing. You go to that area, and you have to make sure that you are out of that area as soon as the game is over, because those of certain ills are not allowed or will be invited into that area. On the other side of the Dan Ryan was one of the longest housing tenements in the United States, which stretched 20 blocks. Robert Taylor Holmes. Also off to the side would be Ida Wells' home. So those from the other side of the Dan Ryan should not be caught over on the inside. You stayed in your area because criminals would be lurking. I remember one time when you get one of those late night phone calls. I received one. It was to come right down to the nuke. 10-minute housing complex that is right south of the Loop. 1:30 in the morning, my child is sick, I need you to anoint. And I am there at 1:30 in the morning, and you think that this is 8 o'clock in the morning, I'm going, so much activity is going on. And because I had a deacon who would travel with me from time to time, I couldn't get him out of bed to cope with me. But we had gone around in certain areas where, hey, it is not safe to be. Well, this could be a problem for those traveling from Jerusalem to Jericho, and this is the only road to go. So verse 31. Now by chance, a certain priest came down that road, and when he saw him, he passed by on the other side. Jericho was one of those cities of priests. When their allotted service in the temple was over, they would return to their home. There are other places they would go when this one was there. The priest was considered the holiest person in Israel. He had the responsibility of offering sacrifices for the sins of the people. He was allowed to go into the temple, whereas other Israelites were not. If anyone is going to reflect the character of God, it would be the priest. He should know the law. He should learn the law. He possibly reasoned in his mind that the man was dead. And if he touched him, he would be unclean for 7 days and would not be able to do what necessary on Lomas Thopis, go back to Jerusalem to serve in the temple, because if you touch a dead body, you are unclean. Leviticus 21, Numbers 19. Both of them mentioned, you are unclean for 7 days. So he couldn't do that. Could have been his rationale, his reasoning. I can't touch that dead body. Verse 32. Likewise, the Levite, when he arrived at the place, came and looked and passed by on the other side. Christ moves down the religious hierarchy to the Levite. The Levite assisted in the temple responsibilities. They were highly regarded among the Israelites and among the Jews, though not considered as holy as the priests. When he sees the victim, he goes near to get a better look. Curious enough to see, is he still alive? Or is he feigning being injured? But there is that curiosity in us. In our country here in the U.S., we call it, when there's an accident on the road, a gaper's delay. There's an accident that happens on the highway, and folks will slow down, and they look, and they look, and they look, until they pass the accident, then they will speed up. But once the Levite's curiosity was satisfied, he too crossed over to the other side. Now today, wisdom dictates that we call blitz instead of necessarily stopping, especially in this country. Other countries, you'd have a smaller population. You may even know the victim. But here in this country, stopping to help an anonymous victim could also be dangerous. Why we need to be wise as serpents and harmless as doves. I remember the Sunday school teacher who asked the kids, what's the best deed you've ever done? One boy said, I helped a friend who was being beat up. The Sunday school teacher said, how did you help it? The boy said, I yelled at the guys for beating him up, and they came up when they started beating me up. You've got to have the care, the concern for the individual, but you also need the wisdom. We must be careful today. That doesn't prevent us from helping. Here, though, we have two of Israel's finest, the priest and the Levite. They would be equivalent today of a prominent, say, a televangelist and a pastor. If anybody was expected to obey the law of love your neighbor, it would be them. But they didn't. They did. Verse 33. But a certain Samaritan, as he journeyed, came where he was, and when he saw him, he had compassion. At this point, most people would have assumed that Jesus, as he is going down the hierarchy from the priest to the Levite, would just simply talk about a simple Jewish layman, somebody like Tavith, a fiddler on the roof. He now is coming by. And now he would help the man, wouldn't he? But no. Jesus Christ then said, a certain Samaritan. Stop the camera. Stop right there. If there's a crowd around him at this point in time, that place would have gotten real quiet, because there was a deep-seated animosity between the Jews and the Samaritans. And the story would have been reported, if we were to look at it through the eyes of today and our prism today, when that story would have been reported on the 6 o'clock news, or even reported on, written up in the Jerusalem Gazette, they would talk about, yes, John Doe was on his way to Jericho, and he got waylaid by criminals. And there was an anonymous individual who came by and helped him. Now John Doe is back at home with his family. Thanks, John Doe, for being such a good person. He would not have identified the Samaritan because of that animosity. You see that brought out in the Gospel of John, where Jesus Christ, when he went to Samaria, and he is there talking to the woman by the well in John chapter 4, and she is questioning, what is it that you are wanting me to give you a drink for? As she said, for Jews have no dealings with Samaritans. And then several chapters later in John 8, when the Jews were trying to do their best to discredit Jesus Christ, and they said, did we not rightly say you are a Samaritan and you have a demon? The hatred between the Jew and the Samaritan in Jesus' day can be compared to the feelings today of the Jews and the Arabs. There is this intense animosity and hatred, even today. Therefore, the Jews could not stand back then at that time Samaritans, and it was reciprocated. Considering the mutual hatred between Jew and Samaritan, they may have expected the Samaritan to go near this victim and finish him off. Find out he's still alive and finish him off. We call this the parable of the Good Samaritan. Even though the word good isn't found in the story, it was not a phrase you would use in the time of Jesus Christ in juxtaposition to a Samaritan. Unless you might introduce another adjective, good riddless Samaritan, not a good Samaritan. They couldn't imagine what Jesus Christ was going to say next. So let's roll the camera, pick it up again. Verse 33. But a certain Samaritan, as he journeyed, he came near where he was. And when he saw him, he had compassion. So he went to him and bandaged his wounds, pouring on oil and wine, set him on his own animal, brought him to an inn, and took care of him. On the next day, when he departed, he took out 2 denarii, gave them to the innkeeper, and said to him, take care of him, and whatever more you spend, when I come again, I will repay you. He was the one who obeyed the law, not the holy, quote-unquote, holy priest, and not the almost holy Levite. But take note, it wasn't a Jew helping a Samaritan, but a Samaritan helping a Jew who was ignored by fellow Jews, including Levites in that group. Here is a Samaritan helping a Jew that was not helped by his own fellow people. Wow. The law says, love your neighbor as yourself. That's what we dealt with last time. In verse 27, it is a citation from Leviticus chapter 19, verse 18, the second part. Benjamin brought out the first part in Leviticus 19, verse 18. It says, you shall not take vengeance, nor bear any grudge against the children of your people. So this is not my people. I don't hurt anybody. That was the mindset back then. And what you would want others to do to you, according to that statement in Leviticus 19:18, the second part, if you have been robbed, if you have been beaten, and you have been left half dead, what would you want? It doesn't take a decree in theology to figure it out. We will want what was done to him by the Samaritan. Clean the wounds, take himself by himself safe, and take care of him till he got back on his feet. That's what the law required. But the religious people would rather debate rather than be neighbor to the individual. The Samaritan risked his own life. He showed compassion. He took care of the maid. He spent his own money in the process. So we come to verse 36, and it says, so which of these three do you think was neighbor to him who fell among the thieves? Christ turns the table on the lawyer. This man was trying to avoid responsibility of being a neighbor to people as he asked this question, who is my neighbor? Love your neighbors yourself. Who is my neighbor? Christ then asked, which of these three men was neighbor to the victim? The big question isn't, who is my neighbor? The question is, to whom can I be a neighbor? Whenever and wherever people need us, there we can be neighbors and show compassion. In verse 37, the lawyer says, he who showed mercy, oh, he couldn't even say the word. Who knows if he's that? He who showed mercy on him, Jesus said to him, go and do likewise. The point is, my neighbor is someone in need. And all of us have needs. And we need to reach out to help. Now we get into lessons of this. I want to ask a question. Which of the characters in this parable or story do I most identify with? Which of them? The thieves? The priests and Levites, kind of lumped them together, or the Samaritan? Asking a question like that is like asking children what position you want to play on the baseball field or the cricket pitch. And just as surely you're going to have people who want to pitch or bat or bowl, I think most of us would identify with the Samaritan. That's the one I most closely resemble. Probably we would think we're in the category of the thieves. For to the thieves, this was a victim to be exploited. When the thieves saw the man traveling down the road, they did not see a fellow human being or a man made in the image of God. They probably didn't even think about God. They saw someone they could exploit. It didn't matter how much they harmed him, so long as they can get from him what they wanted. Their philosophy was, what's yours is mine, and if you don't give it to me, I'll take it. Certainly we don't exploit people, do we? Or do we? Do we use others, especially in the church, to get maybe something that we want? And we were taking advantage of someone in the church because he or she is in the church? I had a member years ago who, in addition to the home he lived in, he owned an apartment. It's where he actually started. He kept it. But he decided he was going to rent the apartment only to church members. And it was a surprise to find out that those who occupied the apartment from time to time would go for months without paying rent. For months. One had the audacity to say, well, the owner, he doesn't really need the money. He's a church man. He doesn't need the money. Is that exploitation? Is that exploitation? It is sad as well to see how many of the modern day priests, Levites, especially in the past, is not that way so much today. But we've had ordained ministers and even deacons who would exploit church members. It was my first introduction into the full-time ministry. The exploitation that occurred. Ever borrowed money from someone and not pay it back? Because that person was in the church or borrowed money from the church and not pay it back because it's the church's responsibility to owe. For the most part, we don't exploit people, do we? Or do we? Or have we? But we probably would not identify with the thieves. We went to the second category. We probably wouldn't think we're in the category of the priest and Levite. For to them, the victim was someone to avoid. Someone to avoid. Oh, how I remember when the AIDS, AIDS, HIV, phenomenon started hitting the fan, getting worse and worse. And I remember as I'm in church after services one day, somebody came up to me visiting church for the first time and indicated to me that he had AIDS. And at that time, we did not know about the transmission of the virus, HIV. Was it passed by fluids, spittle? And I still recall as I'm talking with him, and I got a little bit back from him because he didn't know. And I saw at one point there was spittle that came out because he was getting a little animated. Spittle that came out of his mouth and landed on my coat, and I was wondering, oh no, I might be catching AIDS. More recently, what about COVID? That's more transmissible. Today, and we can get to a point, and wisdom dictates this, we can get to a point where we will pass by on the other side. Yes, we have to be careful. Understand that. But what happens when somebody is in need? Do I avoid that individual altogether? I can imagine the excuses that were made as the priest, Levite, defending their conduct. The priest could be saying, both of them could be saying, I've been serving in the temple all day. I had a deal in my car. Let somebody else do it. Well, I'm on my way home. I've got to see my children. I've got to hurry back and put my children to bed. Let somebody else do it. Levite could have come along and says, well, hey, the priest went by and the priest didn't do it. Why should I help? We can find somebody else to do whatever we think we should be doing but don't want to easily. But as James says, to him who knows to do good and does not do it, to him it is sin. We can rationalize, look, hey, it's not my fault he got waylaid. Maybe it could be. Why isn't it? Why isn't it that road was more secure? Why is it that these criminals are constantly lurking around? Why don't the politicians go ahead and do something about those roads? Read about another mass shooting that took place last night. And then as somebody's reporting, there are more mass shootings this year than there are days in the year that have passed by. And then it seems like after each one, the politicians, Washington, D.C., they need to do something about this. Yep, maybe they should. What about me?
What about me? Look at the example of even Moses. God called it. God said, Moses,
yes, Lord.
I want you to go back to Egypt.
What?
I want you to go back to Egypt.
Why, Lord?
I want you to tell Pharaoh the words that I'm going to give you to say to him.
But
who am I, Lord? Don't worry about it, Moses. I want to be with you, Moses.
Well, Lord, what am I supposed to say?
I'm going to tell you what to say because I am who I am, Moses.
But Lord, they may not believe me.
What's that in your hand, Moses?
It's a shepherd's stick.
Throw it down.
Boom.
As it becomes a snake,
grab it by the tail, and you
don't grab a snake by the tail.
Got a long tail. All the snake will do is curl around and bite you.
He did it. And it became a stake again, a stick again.
He says, I am not eloquent, Lord.
Eloquent, I am not.
Like Yoda.
Because if I made the mouth, then finally the Moses send somebody else, Lord, not me.
So we don't deliberately try to avoid people, do we? Or do we? Therefore, we probably wouldn't identify with priest and Levite. I throw a couple of others in here. We probably wouldn't identify with the lawyer and the innkeeper. Jesus Christ did not include the lawyer and the innkeeper in the story because he says, which of these three in verse 36? But I include them for they help us to better understand ourselves, especially with this story.
We probably wouldn't think we're in the category of the lawyer. For to him, the victim was just a problem to be discussed. Well, the best ways to get nothing done is to discuss it. Discussion had become a substitute for doing. We know with conferences on crimes, yet crime continues to grow. We have seminars on education, yet education continues to decrease and get worse. The lawyer failed to see that the important question wasn't who is my neighbor, but to whom can I be a neighbor. He was comfortable being a spectator, comfortable not showing the concern. Certainly, we can talk about problems. And we, in a sense, show love, don't we? We tithe. We pray. Christ said, pray. We pray. We set an example, don't we?
Or do we? But we probably wouldn't identify with the lawyer. We probably wouldn't think we're in the category of the innkeeper. For to him, he was a customer to serve. The innkeeper possibly served other people because it was his duty. And he was paid to do it. What probably motivated him is, what am I getting out of it? A growing number of people will not lift a finger and serve fellow man unless they hear the right words in answer to the question, what am I going to get out of it? Surely we don't have an ulterior motive when we help someone, do we? Or do? I'm sure if we really prying deeply into this, We can see ourselves in all of them. But we come to Samaria. To the Samaritan, he was a neighbor to serve. A neighbor to serve. Now the last person you would expect to help a Jew would be a Samaritan, but this man did not allow either racial or ethnic or religious barriers to hinder him being this victim as he was. Whether he had any cognizance whatsoever, I don't think he would have protested, because when you are half dead, you forget your prejudices in a hurry. Reminds me of the despondent woman who was walking on the beach when she saw a bottle of sand. She picked it up, pulled the cork out of the top, and whoosh, whoosh, a big puff of smoke appeared. I invoked the genie. You have released me from my prison. To show my thanks, I grant you 3 wishes. But there is a caveat. Whatever you wished for, your husband will get twice as much as your wish. The woman says, why? That bum just left me for another woman. The genie says, sorry, that's the way it is written. So the woman shrugged her shoulders and says, I wish I had $1 billion. Flash of lightning, it was $1 billion at her feet. At the same instance, in a far off place, her wayward husband looked down and he had twice as much. And for your second wish, the genie asked, says, genie, I want the world's most expensive diamond necklace. More expensive than the old diamond, the Koh-i-Noor diamond, the most expensive diamond necklace. Flash of lightning, if he is. Only the most precious treasure in the world. Then shortly thereafter, her husband was looking for Jim Brober because he had twice the value of what she received. She thought, Janie, is it really true my husband has $2 billion and more jewels than I have at this point in time, and he gets double whatever I wish for? The genie says, that's the law. She says, okay, genie, I'm ready for my last wish. She says, I want you to scare me half to death. That's attitude of vengeance. That's not the attitude of the Samaritan. There are 4 characteristics that are brought out here in this story, elements involved in his service to the individual that we highlight. All of them begin with the letter C. The first, compassion. Compassion. Note again, verse 33. But a certain Samaritan, as he journeyed, came near where he was, and when he saw him, he had compassion. The Greek word for compassion comes from the word that refers to the intestines, the bowels. It sounds pretty gross, but it's the equivalent of what we would say is a gut feeling. A gut feeling is when that something happens to you that is so deep, the deepest part of who you are. Almost every time it is used in the New Testament, it refers to the love of Christ or God the Father. I'm not going to turn there. It was even referenced in the Accord by Dr. Levy. The first one over in Matthew chapter 9:36, as Jesus Christ looked out over the multitude, Matthew 9:36, when he saw the multitude, he was moved with compassion inside the bowels. Then in Matthew 14, at the feeding of the 5,000, says when Jesus went out, he saw a great multitude and he was moved with compassion deep down inside. In the next chapter, in chapter 15, verse 32, with the feeding of the 4,000, 15:32, Jesus called his disciples to himself and said, I have compassion on the multitude because they have now continued with me 3 days and have nothing to eat. I have compassion. Then there are three parables in which it is used to refer to Jesus Christ and to the Father. The parable of the unforgiving servant in Matthew chapter 18. When Peter asked him, how often should my brother sin against me and I forgive him? Seven times? Christ says, no, to 70 times seven. And you have this unforgiving servant who was forgiven a massive debt, but he would not forgive someone that owed him a mere pittance. And then in Luke 15, we have the prodigal son story, in which the father had compassion on his son. And here in Luke chapter 10, in the story of the Good Samaritan, it's a deep compassion. It's a compassion that insists on taking action. When that Samaritan looked at this suffering man lying half dead on the side of the road, something happened in his gut. Something that made it impossible for him to walk away. He didn't decide to help the guy on the basis of his worth. He helped him because of how needy he was. Yeah, he could have been a wealthy man in the Jewish society. And maybe there's this motive on the part, well, maybe I can get something from him. That wasn't his attitude. This man was in need. And this is a gut level, real life compassion that sees that desperation. Another scripture to tie in here is over at 1 John chapter 3, 17 in the King James. 1 John 3, 17, King James. But whoso adds this world's good and sees his brother have need and shuts up his bowels of compassion from him, how dwells the love of God in him? Real Christians display real compassion. They don't shut down that feeling in the gut when they see a pain, when they see a need. They do whatever it takes to take care of the individual, but we have gotten so insulated these days. And I believe it is because of our information age. We have been overloaded. The news cycle of 24/7 is now you start concerning yourself with one situation, and within 30 minutes, something else comes up. And then 30 minutes after that, something else comes up. You forget. You forget about the first one. We have been so overloaded with so much in this world, it has been overwhelmed. And it's difficult to act. But the Samaritan didn't think about that. He recognized the gut feeling and he acted. Two, second C, contact. Compassion one, two, contact. Verse 34, first part. So he went to him and bandaged his wounds. He initiated the contact. How many parents, mothers especially, have maybe even risked their lives to hold a child that had some contagious disease during a dignity play? How many? That are all saying the song, reach out and touch somebody's hand, make this world better for us if you can. How many? How many? Different cultures have that ability to touch. Middle Eastern, they touch. I've watched Middle Eastern men kiss each other on the lips. Different from here in the United States. I remember when we moved down to Barbados 40 years ago, we went to lunch after services at the Strong's. Ivy Donovan had been so instrumental in helping us make the adjustment, transitioning into Barbadian life. And I was sitting next to Ivan. And he was making the point. Now, Ivan has come and he has spent time in the U.S. He was making a point. And as he was making a point, he's reaching over and he is touching my leg. He made not funny, touching the leg. After a while, as he was making his point and touching my leg, my head was going down with his finger. He made the point, my head was going down. Then he finally called out, "Oops, excuse me, I don't mean anything by it. We like to touch. We like to touch." Something about that touch that is so important. He could have excused helping by thinking the robbers are still around. He could be a decoy. It's too far gone. Love doesn't look at obstacles. It looks for opportunities. It looks for opportunity. Compassion. Contact. Number three, care. Care. Second part of verse 34. Pouring on oil and wine, he set him on his own animal, brought him to an inn, and took care of him. The late Mother Teresa once put it like this. She says, quote, "The biggest disease today is not leprosy or cancer." As how many years she spent in leper colonies. "It's the feeling of being uncared for or unwanted, of being deserted and alone. The greatest evil is the lack of love and charity and an indifference toward one's neighbor who may be the victim of poverty or disease or exploited and at the end of his life left at a roadside." Sometimes we refuse to care because it's inconvenient. We're not sure if our caring or help is even wanted or needed. Or maybe we are angry because nobody cared for me. Or it's not in my best interest. And we become isolated and different. There was a sign in a gas station years ago, posted for the employees of the gas station. And it was entitled, "Why Customers Quit." Why customers quit. And the sign went along this path. 1% die. 3% move away. 5% form new friendships. 9% find lower prices elsewhere. 14% become dissatisfied with the product. But 68% quit because of an attitude of indifference toward them by some employee. And that can happen in church as well. If we don't care, we don't care. Compassion. Care. We come to number four. After the contact and the care, four is cost. Compassion, contact, care. Number four is cost. Verse 35, "On the next day when he departed, he took out 2 denarii, gave them to the innkeeper, said to him, 'Take care of him. Whatever more you spend when I come again, I will repay you.'" Cost. Money. Cost him money. 2 denarii. It's like 2 days' wait. We're dealing with hundreds of dollars. And he was able to spend out for this individual. Cost him time. Time is such a precious commodity in our world today, isn't it? How important it is for us. There was a Pennsylvania consulting firm a few years ago released one of its studies estimating the amount of time the average American will spend doing various things. A few years back, but the results are not encouraging. Consider time spent opening junk mail, 8 months. Time spent sitting at soundlights, 6 months. Time spent searching for misplaced objects, 1 year. Time spent trying to return phone calls, 2 years. Time spent doing housework, 4 years. Time spent standing in line, 5 years. And then time spent watching TV, 9.1 years. And watching commercials, over 2 years. Watching commercials. When the Samaritan stopped along the road to assist a fellow traveler, he was willing to sacrifice his time. Willing to sacrifice his money. Even though we may admit that we do not act like the Samaritan on a consistent basis in our lives, we still figure in this story that he is the one that we probably will identify with most. But I inject the thought. I inject the thought that probably the character we should first identify with is not a Samaritan, but the victim. The victim. That anonymous, beaten, bloody nobody lying helpless by the side of the road. Let's go back here to Ezekiel chapter 16. I've turned to any other scriptures, and there's only other one turning to refer to several. But here's this allegory, a very familiar allegory, as God is talking about his interaction with his bride, Israel. But it certainly pertains to us. Ezekiel chapter 16, beginning with verse 1. It says, again, the word of the Lord came to me, saying, Son of man, cause Jerusalem to know her abominations, and say, thus says the Lord God to Jerusalem, your birth, your nativity from the land of Canaan, your father an Amorite, your mother a Hittite. As for your nativity, on the day you were born, your navel cord was not cut, nor were you washed in water to cleanse you. You were not rubbed with salt or wrapped in swaddling clothes, though I pitied you to do any of these things for you, to have compassion on you, but you were thrown out into the open field when you yourself were loath on the day you were born. Now make the comparison. Comparison of the actions of priests, the Levite, the thieves, contrasted with the Samaritan. Contrasted with the Samaritan. Verse 6, when I passed by you and saw you struggling in your blood at the side of the road, I said to you, in your blood, live. Yes, I said to you, in your blood, live. I made you stride like a plant in the field, and you grew, you matured, you became very beautiful. Your breasts were formed. Your hair grew, but you were naked and bare, and when I passed by you again, and I looked at you, indeed your time was the time of love. So I spread my wing over you and covered your nakedness. Yes, I swore an oath to you and entered into a covenant with you, and you became mine, says the Lord, compassion. Compassion. Preparative of Good Samaritan. Compassion. Verse 9, then I washed you in water. Yes, I thoroughly washed off your blood, and I anointed you with oil. Compare it to the Samaritan. Contact. Contact. Verse 10, I clothed you in embroidered cloth, and I gave you sandals of badger skin. I clothed you with fine linen, covered you with silk. I adorned you with ornaments and put bracelets on your wrists, a chain on your neck. I put a jewel in your nose, earrings in your ear, and a beautiful crown on your head. Thus you were adorned with gold and silver, and your clothing was of fine linen, silk, embroidered cloth. You ate pastry of fine flour, honey, and oil. You were exceedingly beautiful and succeeded to royalty. Care. Care. In verse 14, your fame went out among the nations because of your beauty, for it was perfect through my splendor, which I had bestowed on you, says the Lord. Cost. Stop and consider that we are the ones in need of help, not the helpers. And if that is the case, who is the Good Samaritan? None other than Jesus Christ. Christ entered our existence. Our existence, and he brought with him that love. He brought that compassion,
that contact, that care, that cost his own life as he provided for us. And now is our high priest. Now, he says to us, victim,
go and do likewise. Go and do likewise. We must follow his example, minister to others, those in need, and not discriminate because everyone has needs, but that compassion, that contact, that care, that cost, that we analyze it, that's what he did for us. Now he wants us to do it for one another. Robert Cobb's book, All I Really Need to Know, I Learned in Kindergarten, I've cited it before. But in part of it, he mentions about an individual, as he is recounting the story of an individual by the name of V.P. Minnan. V.P. Minnan, one of the significant political figures in India as the nation was struggling for independence from Britain. He says that Minnan was a self-made man, but he was one of oldest of 12 children. He quit school at 13. He was a laborer, he was a coal miner, backroom hand, merchant, school teacher, clerk in the administration. But when he arrived, he got waylaid at the train station. And he asked for Sikh for 15 rupees. The Sikh gave it to him with the intention of others, which is what he did for the rest of his life. But as Fulgil wraps up the story, he says this: on several occasions when I have thought about the story of the Good Samaritan, I have wondered about the rest of the story. What effect did the charity have on the man who was robbed and beaten and taken care of? Did he remember the cruelty of the robbers and shaped his life with that memory? Or did he remember the nameless generosity of the Samaritan and shaped his life with that debt? What did he pass on to the strangers in his life, those in need he met? Start with the victim. Move to Christ as the Good Samaritan. And the admonition, and not to condemn the order, not to condemn the priest, the Levites, the thieves, but also now follow his instructions. Go and do likewise. Do we remember the thieves, those who exploited us, those who have avoided us? Yeah. Do we remember the priests and the Levites who avoided us? Yeah. Do we remember the Good Samaritan, Jesus Christ, who helped us with the compassion, with the contact, with the care, and the cost? If that resonates, this story then, Christ says to you and to me, go and do likewise.